afternoon, good evening, and good morning, wherever you are, whenever you are, and welcome to the Godcast. If you have any questions about the Christian faith, whatever they may be, get in touch with us at thegodcasttjc@gmail.com. Today, we have something very special, an interview with Dr. E. Michael Jones, author of such excellent works as Libido Dominandi, Barren Metal, and The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Let's listen.
My name is Super Lutheran, and with me here is Stug Life, and we have a very special guest for you today. Most of you already know him from Libido Dominandi, from Slaughter of Cities, and from many other works, the one and the only Mr. E. Michael Jones.
Yep, here I am. Thank you.
it's a great pleasure to have you, sir. And unfortunately, as an interdenominational audience that we have, there's a lot of people that are probably listening that might not be as familiar with your work as they ought to be. So we were hoping for to start things off with just what is the basic doctrine of the Logos as you see it?
Yeah, well, I have spent the last couple of years traveling all around the world and engaging in conversations with people all over the world. Part of what I'm realizing is that what we have in common is what you would call logos. We are all rational creatures who have the ability to speak. That is what defines us as people. Now, I started thinking about logos in a systematic way when I started Greek as an undergraduate. And I remember turning to the Greek English dictionary and seeing page after page of English equivalents to logos, and realizing that we didn't have all of these equivalents. The crucial passage in this regard became for me the Gospel of St. John, because I remember reading it, obviously, in English. In the beginning, there was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And for the life of me, I couldn't understand what that meant. I didn't know what you were talking about. I mean, I read it over and over and over again, couldn't figure it out. But then I read it in Greek. And in Greek, it's en arche en ha logos. Kai logos en pros theon. Kai logos en theos. So suddenly I realized that he was using the word logos, where we were using the word word. And all of those pages that there applied to this word logos. In other words, it was just bigger than the word word. It meant rationality. It meant the order of the universe. There was a whole kind of philosophical background behind this word that I was gradually becoming aware of in other courses that I was taking at this time. And so I began to realize that there was some significance here. I used it, kind of stumbled across it when I did the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, which was about, 15 years ago, I started it. And in this, I realized I needed this word logos in order to create the thesis of my book, because the book was about the Jews, and nobody knew how to define a Jew. Some people were claiming it was biological, some people claiming ethnic, some people claiming whatever. And I started to realize that in order to write this book, I had to define the Jew. And in order to find what the Jew was, I had to use the word logos. So what I said was that at the time of Christ, the Jews had to either accept or reject their Messiah, who was known as the Logos, according to St. John. And the Jews who accepted him became known as the Church, or Christians. The Jews who rejected him are known as Jews. And when you reject Logos, you reject all of those things that were listed in that Greek dictionary. All of those things, you reject it in some way, in some fundamental. And when you reject Logos, you reject the order of the universe. And when you reject the order of the universe, you become a revolutionary. And that's what the Jews have been for 2,000 years now. They've been revolutionaries. And that book is about 1,200 pages of description of their revolutionary activity, all the way from the foot of the cross up to gay marriage. So the word logos, then people kept asking me about it when I use it in that term, and suddenly I realized I have to write a book about it. And so what I'm writing now is a book about logos, about the emergence of reason in human history, and then the history of reason in human history. And so I'm calling the book the History of Logos, but also the Logos of History. Because as soon as we have Jesus Christ, which means God entering history, it changes everything. Because now history has a meaning that it didn't have before, certainly not with the Greeks, who basically debated among themselves in one of the greatest intellectual productions in human history, debated over centuries about the order of the universe, beginning by saying that it was made up of water and then air and then fire. And then finally, with Anaxagoras, saying there's a mind behind this. And logos is the operating system of the mind. And this culminated in the discussions between Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And a kind of impasse got reached at this point. Because on one hand, you had God as the uncaused cause and unmoved mover, which was Aristotle's definition, which means he's completely transcendent, which is fine, except that you don't know whether he cares about you or not. And then you have Plato saying, well, he's the demiurge, he's the worker of the people, which means he's really cares about you, but he's not really transcendent. So you can't have it both ways. Which is it? And that the resolution to that conflict was known as the Trinity. And after that point, which is basically what John is talking about in those three sentences in Greek, when you're with God and you're God, that's really a description of the Trinity. After that, if you don't get that right, you are not part of the movement of logos in history. And so I discussed groups at that point, like Islam, which came about as a result of a lot of historical forces, but largely out of heresy, specifically Nestorianism. Which understood that, felt that God, Jesus Christ, was man, but not God. Some people thought he was God, but not man. And you're back there with the same dichotomy that you saw with Plato and Aristotle. Is he God or is he man? Well, he's both. And he's, as a matter of fact, he's true God and true man. And it took that council, it took hundreds of years before the council of, I believe it was Chalcedon, where they hammered out that definition. And unless you got that right, if you didn't get that right, you missed the boat. Human history passed you by. The history of Logos passed you by. And so to get back to Islam, they felt that God was completely transcendent and that you had no freedom whatsoever and you just bowed down before God and that was it. There was no secondary causality in Islam. God, Maimonides, the medieval Jewish philosopher, said that God for the Muslim was like the caliph who took a ride in his carriage in the afternoon. And when he got to the gate of the palace grounds, he made a left turn or a right turn, but even he didn't know which turn he was going to make until he got there. And so understanding the universe meant for a Muslim understanding the mind of God, which even he didn't understand. So as a result, you can't know anything. And so as a result, science did not develop in the Islamic world because there was no secondary causality in the Islamic world. And so it moved to the the European world, specifically Paris in the 13th century. Bishop Tompier condemns Averroism. Averroes was the philosopher, the Islamic philosopher who had a huge influence on people like Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages. And he said that there are two truths. Aristotle said the world is eternal. The Quran says it's created in time. And Averroes says, well, they're both right. One's right for philosophy, one's right for theology. Now, whether Averroes said that or not, there are people, C.J. of Brabant in Paris said that Averroes said it. It came known as Averroism and it was condemned. And because it was condemned, because the idea of two truths were condemned, science developed in the West in a way that it did not develop in the Islamic world. So again, everything grows and dies. Everything human, everything created grows and dies. And philosophy is in many ways no exception to this rule. So scholasticism grew and then it died. And it died in Germany. And I was there where it died because I was in Munich in October. And I ate at the Franciscaner, which is now a restaurant, but it used to be a monastery. And that's where William of Ockham died in the plague of Black Death during the middle of the 14th century. Okay. And with him, that whole scholastic synthesis died. And William of Ockham became famous for something called nominalism. And William of Ockham's probably most famous student was Martin Luther. So I'm trying to bring this up to some type of relevance to our group here. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1770, a guy was born by the name of Hegel. He's an exact contemporary of Beethoven. Hegel was in the seminary. He was 19 years old in 1789, and in that year, the French Revolution broke out. And Hegel is studying Lutheran theology, studying at the Tübinger Stift, which is a seminary for Lutheran theologians. It is probably the most famous class in Lutheran theology in German history, because Schelling is also a student, and the poet, the great poet, Hölderlin, is also a student there. And they're grappling with this conflict that they're right in the middle of. They're all Lutherans, and they're all sympathizers with the French Revolution. So how do you bring Luther and the French Revolution together? That's the task that's facing them. And the answer, it turns out, is the Trinity. And it turns out that if you don't get the Trinity right, as I said, you don't get anything right, especially in these higher levels. And so there's a huge back and forth. One of the greatest periods of intellectual debate in human history. I'm talking about Germany during the period of the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. It's comparable to Athens in the 4th century BC. You've got Immanuel Kant, who has basically resurrected philosophy, given it a new lease on life, because he says he's resurrected the ability of the mind to actually have a positive impact on reality, in reaction to David Hume, who just marched off into skepticism, and English philosophy has never recovered from David Hume. Mind here is a constitutive in part of the universe. The categories of space and time are categories of the mind. The mind is now powerful again. And he's attracting followers. Fichte, the first follower, direct follower of Kant, says it's time to abolish the Ding an Sie. There's nothing but mind. And that's the step he takes. And then there's a problem there, because if there's nothing but mind, how do you know that anything is real? Okay. And then Schelling takes this a step further and says, well, it's the mind of God, the absolute. And in a sense, that's true, because everything is fundamentally a thought in the mind of God. Okay. But where does that leave you? And so Hegel comes in. And Hegel is involved in trying to resolve this issue. The issue is, how do you make what's known, what you think, how does that become real? I mean, obviously, in the mind of God, if he thinks it's real. But what about your mind? What's your relationship between your mind and God's mind? Okay, can you think it and make it real? If you think you have $100 in your wallet, does that mean you have $100 in your wallet?
One can only wish, sir.
Yeah. And at this time, Hegel meets Goethe. And Goethe is writing a play called Faust. And in Faust Part 2, he deals with that specific issue, because he deals with paper money. So in a sense, the Federal Reserve is a godlike institution, because if they think there's $100 in your account, you have $100 in your account, because it's thought, it comes out of pure air. Okay? That's a long, complicated story that I can talk about, that I talk about in my book, Barren Metal, which is a history of capitalism as a conflict between labor and usury. But I want to get to the crisis here. There's a crisis coming up. I know this is a long, winded discussion, beginning here, but you asked for it. Okay. And I'm going to give it to you. So the crisis comes here in 1806. A Frenchman by the name of Napoleon marches into Jena, which is where Hegel is living, and he defeats the Prussian army. And then he rides into Jena on a horse, and Hegel peeks out his window. I don't know whether he peeked out his window, but he saw Napoleon, and he said, "This is the Zeitgeist, the Weltgeist on horseback, the Weltgeist zu Pferd." Okay. And Prussia is now a conquered country. The Enlightenment has taken over Prussia. And Hegel is in the middle of writing his book, The Phenomenology of Spirit. Okay? And in the preface to this book, he says, a child is born. A child is born. He's trying to talk about the dialectic. The dialectic is based on the Trinity. An sich, für sich, an und für sich. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. He says the best example of this is human sexuality, the family, male coming together with female, his opposite, and creating a synthesis, which is the child. And he says a child is born. Okay? Well, that he meant that in a number of different ways. One of them was autobiographical. Okay, now this is a project that I think is worth doing right now, because whether you're, no matter what you, what type of Christian you are, I think that you believe with Anselm that theology is trying to understand faith. We're here not simply to accept it. We're here to also to understand it. Hegel would say you're here to know God, which means you have to try to understand God. And there's some sense in which that's exactly what Hegel's trying to do. He understands that the Trinity here is the key to understanding everything, because it's the basis of God's existence, and God's existence is the basis of every other existence. So naturally, we're going to see evidence of the Trinity in all creation. Okay, not the same, but we'll see evidence of it. So it's an important project. But it's a difficult project, because you're at the outer limit of human understanding here. You're at the outer limit of logos from a human perspective, because now you're dealing with something that the human mind could not have known by itself. God had to tell you that he was God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, because you could never figure that out on your own. So you're up at like Mount Everest now. You're in the dead zone of Mount Everest. Okay, which has been in the news a lot lately. Okay, there's about 30% oxygen here, and you're really having to, you take them three breaths in order to get enough oxygen, and it's hard, it's difficult. The mind keeps failing at this point, and at this crucial moment, Hegel is in exactly the wrong position, okay, for doing this, because when he says a child is born, he's talking about something very literal. Okay, as well as something very philosophical. He's talking about his chambermaid. The chambermaid has announced to Hegel that she is pregnant with his child. Okay, so it's like neck and neck. We're coming down to the finish line. You got Napoleon destroying Prussia. You've got the chambermaid pregnant with his child. And he's writing the prolegomena to the Phenomenology of the Spirit, with the cannons going off in the background and this kind of dread of the future. And what I'm saying here is, to get to make a long story short, is that this drove him into the arms of Lutheran theology. I mean, he was always there to begin with, but it drove it in a very specific way into the notion of the enslaved will. And in doing that, he basically brought about the end of the project. The project failed at that point. because at that point, he had to put evil in God. And his notion of the Trinity was basically the dialectic, and the dialectic was being and non-being, and then some type of synthesis after that. And he could evolve everything out of the conflict between non-being and being, but the conflict between non-being and being was not the Trinity. It's impossible to have evil or non-being in God, because God is perfect being. So what happened is he came up with an explanation, and the explanation basically made his career, but it proved catastrophic for the development of European history after that. I'm talking specifically about one of his first students, namely Ludwig Feuerbach, who was a student of his in Berlin, and basically wrote to Hegel, a 24-year-old, very bright 24-year-old. Germany was full of bright 24-year-olds at this point. And he wrote to Hegel and he said, look, this dialectic works fine without God. You don't need God for the dialectic. And so it led directly to atheism in Feuerbach's mind. And then Feuerbach's mind led directly to Karl Marx. Karl Marx read it. And then you had communism flowing out of Hegel. Marx called himself a dialectical materialist. And what you're saying here is, okay, you have two fundamental issues here. Empedocles said that the world is a function of love and strife. John comes along and says God is love, and that's it. And strife is not part of it. And then Hegel comes along and resurrects strife as the fundamental principle of the universe. Darwin picks this up, and it becomes Darwinian evolution, which is a catastrophe for the Western world. And Karl Marx picks it up and turns it into communist revolution, which is the opposite catastrophe for the Western world. And we've been struggling to overcome this ever since. Okay, there's my too long introduction, but that's my sense of what needs to be said right now to this audience.
It is interesting that you mentioned Kant coming in after the crisis that Hume kind of almost killed philosophy with. But Hume, it's interesting to note that the skeptics got everything that they had, including what would become the biblical liberal schools, right?
Right.
All that comes from Spinoza, Benedict Spinoza, who just so happened to be Jewish.
Right. Spinoza had a huge influence on all the German idealists, and especially Kant. Basically, what Fichte did was turn the absolute substance, which is what Spinoza was talking about, that's Spinoza's pantheism, into the absolute subject. Well, they're pretty much the same thing. But yeah, you're right. Spinoza had a huge influence on all these people.
Yeah, I would almost go as far to say that he started it. But
I would say Descartes started it, and I would say Descartes started it, and Spinoza tried to reconcile the dichotomy in Descartes between the res cogitans and the res extensa. But you know, every place is a starting point in some sense or other.
So from that being said, though, there is obviously a big time gap between when all these things happened that gave us postmodernity. And now, and I know my friend Spooky here had some excellent questions he wanted to ask on that. For young men living in today's world, and the explosion of identitarianism, as well as the sexual slavery of our age, Spooky, did you want to talk about that for a while?
I actually had a couple of questions that were directed towards this type of discussion. So. One of them is with with specifically the resurrection of identity politics in the way that it has been. I personally tend to not fall into the hard identifying specifically as nothing but white. It's just a descriptor for me.
Right.
I identify as North Carolinian first and Catholic, not white. But there's a lot of men who have nothing to attach to. And I was wondering, because I've heard you talk on this a bit, what you would suggest for that. Because if they have religion, they can attach. But that feels, I don't want to say it feels hollow, but it feels partially incomplete because you're missing the familial attachment where, you know, half the guys, you know, around, they couldn't tell you who their second great grandfather was.
Right. Right. You're absolutely right. What were the rise of identity politics, both on the left and on the right, is a function of the collapse of the overarching narratives that gave people identity. So one of the first identities right now is America. Let's be honest. There's no America anymore. Does anybody identify as an American? No. Trump tried to resurrect this with Make America Great Again, and he got elected because there's this hunger for this. Let's go other overarching identities. My personal feeling from having been there is that Protestantism, the official churches in England and Scandinavia are collapsing. They are basically losing their adherence. The people don't identify with these churches anymore. If you talk to a guy like Hedrick on Red Ice Radio, he's a white guy because he's not a Lutheran. So what you have in these countries is, on the one hand, like England, for example, if you're a male, you now identify yourself as white and you become involved in white ethnic nationalism. If you're a female, oftentimes you become a Muslim. And these are obviously identities that fill in for the collapse of the overarching narrative. What I'm saying, I agree with you, white has no meaning whatsoever. Okay, it is a negative descriptor that comes into being as soon as someone black shows up in your neighborhood. I cover this in Slaughter of Cities, which is my book about urban renewal and ethnic cleansing. It's about social engineering and basically the destruction of the engine of identity in the northern and eastern cities of the United States, which was basically the ethnic neighborhood. The ethnic neighborhood was largely Catholic. You had an identity, as I did when I was a very young boy, as an Irish Catholic who lived in a Catholic parish in North Philadelphia. That identity was destroyed for me. We didn't know what happened, what was happening to us when the black people crossed Lehigh Avenue in 1954, and we moved to what was in effect a suburb. And by moving there, you became in effect white. Now, there was a problem here in the United States of America because people tend to intermarry. So my grandfather from Ireland had six children, and only one of them married an Irishman. But all of them, my father married a German, my uncle married an Italian or Pole, my aunt married an Italian, and so on and so forth. But they were all Catholic. And the people who paid attention to this described it as the triple melting pot, which is basically a sociological theory. It came into being in the 1930s when there were basically three groups. And it says no matter where you came from in Europe, after three generations, your ethnic identity became your religion. And so there were three ethnic groups based on three religions, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. I think that this is still valid. I think that if you're a Protestant, if you're a Catholic, or if you're a Jew, you have an ethnic identity, a real identity in America, in spite of all of the conflict, in spite of all of the deracination and social engineering that's been imposed upon us.
So you're saying that even if there is no ethnic component, you should still emphasize the religious component.
No, I'm saying the ethnic component is the religious component.
Okay.
That's it. So I've said before, America is like Yugoslavia, three ethnic groups based on three religions. I'm saying that the religion actually has a content, unlike white, which has no content. And so the rise, what I've said before is a white guy is a Protestant who doesn't go to church anymore because you don't have an identity. There are plenty of groups out here who will try and sell you an identity. You can buy a Harley Davidson motorcycle and that will give you an identity. You wear ethnic clothing. You can wave to other guys on motorcycles as you drive around. Or you can go to NASCAR races and that's an identity. Professional sports teams are also identity designators. These are all attempts to make up for the fact that you're lacking something, that you don't know who you are. And we like the oligarchs like the fact that you don't know who you are, because if you knew who you were, you might resist what they're trying to do to you.
You know, I emphasized, you know, just a bit ago that I identify very heavily as North Carolinian and as a Southerner.
Yes.
Do you have any like ideas on how those can be maintained, the few holdouts that exist? Because those are dramatically different than viewing yourself as, you know, just American or white. There's very real culture. There's very real roots there. My family's been in North Carolina for 400 years almost at this point. And it's not a fun identity. It's the real thing.
Well, how does religion factor into your identity? Is it part of your identity?
Oh yes, sir. I'm Catholic, but my family's interesting with that because it involved Bavarians moving over and marrying in, but that's a whole different subject.
Yeah, yeah. North Carolina is largely Scotch-Irish. Traditionally, the people who rose up against the English in Scotland were given a choice of being hanged immediately or dying of exhaustion working as an indentured slave in North Carolina. So I'm sure they deliberated long and hard before they made that choice. But you've got groups of people coming there, and you're living in a certain place with a certain group of people, and you live there long enough, you have an identity. Community is based on geographical area. It's not a society. It's a group of people that live in a certain place, and over that period of time, I mean, basically, I should be asking you the question because you have lived in one place. Your family's lived there for a long time, and you should tell us how you preserved your identity, because I think that's exactly what needs to happen. People live in a place; they have a religious identity that allows them to develop in a particular place. I gave a speech in Mexico. David Duke was there. I tried to convert David Duke to Catholicism in Mexico, in Guadalajara. But I gave an ebook called Ethnos Needs Logos. And I'm saying that I mentioned the Guarani in Paraguay. I got up there and I said that Guarani was one of the languages of the original inhabitants of Paraguay. And it is now one of the official languages of Paraguay to this day. Now, why is that? Well, it's because the Jesuits came and walked into the forest there and basically wrote the grammar and dictionary of the Guarani language. It's in the movie The Mission, if you want to see some type of graphic representation of what I'm talking about. But basically, you need these two components. You can't just have an ethnicity because the ethnicity cannot survive all by itself. Historically, that's simply the case. You have to have some type of universalizing element entering into the concrete in order to have a full type of existence. And you probably figured out now I'm talking about logos again here, because logos has to be universal and particular. And that's precisely why the Trinity is the solution to the entire the problems of the entire world, because it is both at the same time.
Okay, so for a lot of people out there, that would they be fine with your plan? They would be 100%. Then they look at their heritage, they look at their geography, where they are, where they came from. What happens when they don't like what they see? So I'm not from the state I'm living in, but I'm in Washington State right now, West Coast. There is cultural AIDS everywhere where I'm living in. And if someone goes out, okay, well, I can emphasize the heritage of the pioneers that came here. Well, that's not Washington right now. And most of the people that have been living here their entire lives, what you could say would be an incipient ethnic group. Well, it's disgusting. Do I really want to identify with that in any way, shape, or form?
Yes, you're right. You're right. And so we're going to focus on the existential situation of one human being, okay, you have to make contact with Logos. And the only way we make contact with Logos fully is through baptism, because that is the way it is now. If it were Athens in the 4th century BC, I'd tell you something else. But this is the way it is right now, okay? And that means you have to become a member of the church. Okay. And that means that by doing that, you will connect with God's plan in a very intimate way, And God's plan for you then will be that you connect, because that's what God's plan is. And so if you're a young man, this means most likely you'll find someone and you will marry that person. And then you will start over, in a sense, at ground zero, because everyone has to start at ground zero, no matter where you come from, whether you've been in North Carolina for 400 years or whether you arrived the day before yesterday, you still have to live your life. And this is the way human beings live their lives. This is the most basic way that a human being imitates the Trinity, by meeting a member of the opposite sex, joining with that member of the opposite sex, and producing offspring. So now you're part of the continuity of history. And even if everything has been totally messed up to this point, you can still save it by lead a successful life by doing what I just said. So that reduces it to some type of existential point here. Now, to get into the reality of the situation, the simplest way for someone to screw up your life for you is to get you involved in sexual liberation. Because that will disrupt your connection with Logos. I talk about this in Libido Dominandi. I'm talking about it very specifically in the context of Wilhelm Reich, the Jewish communist who was also a psychoanalyst in Vienna during the 1930s, who was at war with the Catholic Church and at war with everything the church stood for, and realized that talking about communism got nowhere, but if he talked about sex, he could get a big crowd and they were always interested. And the main opponent was the Catholic clergy. And he said, if you get the clergy involved in sexual deviance, like masturbation, you don't have to debate the existence of God. The existence of God will disappear. It will evaporate from that guy's mind and you will have him under control. This man, as I point out in Libido Dominandi, is one of the architects of the slavery that we now live under in the United States of America, because sexual liberation is a form of political control. And the oligarchs, as exhibited by the New York Times, knew what Reich was talking about. And the people, he ended up on the cover of the New York Times magazine in 1970. So these ideas are widespread. This is why we have pornography on cell phones, because it's a form of control. So the first thing that will disrupt that plan that I told you about connecting with Logos is your cell phone and pornography.
Well, that being said, we can move right on to Spooky's last question that he brought up of escaping the grasp of sexual freedom.
So
it's called self-control. It's called imposing reason on passion. Now, the Greeks knew this very well, okay? You want to read their take on it. You can read Euripides. You can read Hippolytus. Hippolytus is about a man who brags about controlling his horses, which is the image for passion in Greek literature. And he tries his damnedest, and he ends up being trampled to death by his own horses, because he offends some god or other. That's Greek tragedy in a nutshell. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. Okay? That is not our situation, because we live in a redeemed world. So I can tell you, E. Michael Jones says, don't watch pornography if you want a successful life. And you can say, yes, I agree with you, and then you can fail because you're addicted. That's the nasty thing about this whole thing. It leads to an addiction. So I'm talking about the difference between my word and God's word. When God says it, it happens. And so if you connect with that Logos, with the Logos, the ultimate Logos, you won't just get the bad news that you're addicted. You will get power or grace or whatever you want to call it. You will get power to overcome these problems and end up with a successful life and go to heaven and spend eternity with God. That's what I believe, because I'm a Christian. I believe that the Logos is actually not just a plan. It's not just geometry. It is geometry, but it's more than geometry. It's a person. And it's not only a person, it's a person who cares about you and can make, can situate you in the matrix of Logos so that you are successful. Now that's pretty significant, I think.
So that being said, for our readers, especially our Roman Catholic readers, and I myself, there's a lot of help if you read Brother Lawrence's Practicing the Presence of God.
Okay.
That can help you when you're talking about connecting to the Logos. For some people, that can, they might want a spiritual way of understanding that power, and Practicing the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence would be a good resource for them to look up. Good Catholic monk from Germany that actually fought us Lutherans back in the 1600s, I want to say. Late 1600s.
Yes, God bless him.
So, yeah. Speaking of that kind of fighting, though, so the Godcast is a somewhat ecumenical movement. We practice what we call ecumenism from the trenches. We decided that if we are all going to hold to the Word of God as truth, the Scripture being the Word of God, and we're going to hold to traditional morality because of that, we have a lot more that we agree on than we disagree on.
Right.
But my question to you then is, if you've experienced this, or if you're going to be looking at building any sort of Christian movement against the forces against Logos, how do you get around internecine squabbles like that? Because we have Catholics saying everything went wrong with Martin Luther. Then you have the Orthodox rebutting that, no, it all started with the Great Schism, you people adding the filioque. And then the Protestants will go, wait a second. You want to say that Luther started modernism when, I mean, that's like saying Catholicism started Catharism, or that Borgia's popes, they did everything they did because Catholicism results in it. So how do you get all these squabbles and you get these infighting, and it makes a lot of unification difficult. And I was wondering if you had your take on that or any experiences you'd like to share regarding that kind of cooperation.
Yes, I have. I've had a lot of experience. That's why I'm writing this book, because Logos is the solution to this problem. I'll take it a step back from this, from what we just said. I've had a lot of conversations with Muslims, in particular Iranians, you know, and so you get into these discussions and you think, are we going to have Islamic Catholic dialogue here? And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I'm interested in unprotected intercourse. That's what I said. I was in Qom talking to the mullah in Qom about sex, and we got nowhere. We got absolutely nowhere. I've talked to this guy a number of times. I just can't get to first base with this guy. Okay, so the other mullah took me out on the balcony, and he said, "We're not trying to convert you. You're a believer." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "We're going to wait. We will work for justice until the 12th Imam returns from the state of occultation and Jesus will be at his side." So I said, "Okay, I agree with that." So what I'm trying to say here is that I know we've been wounded. I mean, if there's ever a place that was wounded, it was Germany, and it was wounded by the Reformation. Or you could say, maybe you say, it was wounded by the Fuggers collecting taxes for indulgences or whatever it was. But the fact of the matter is that there has been a division and it's had a devastating effect on the West. Okay. And now we are reaping the consequences of it because there's this division all over the place. All I'm saying is my solution is Logos. And in order to attain Logos, we have to be docile. And docile means being docile to the truth. And that's what I mean by unprotected intercourse. So I had long, long, candid, brutally candid conversations with this Muslim woman about Islam. It didn't change my views. It helped me understand the situation better. And that's all I can propose. We have to get back to do some type of real research into what happened here. What happens to Europe at this time. And that's why I'm talking about Hegel, why I began with Hegel, because in a sense, we are still living the consequences of the Reformation. And we are still living the consequences of the enslaved will of Luther's idea. And I think we need to examine that, examine what happened. There's a chapter in Degenerate Moderns on Luther where I talk about the enslaved will and where it came from. Well, I think it's still true. I think it had a devastating effect on everything, but especially the moral law. But now I'm coming back to it. I'm saying it had a devastating effect on Hegel's understanding of the Trinity. And because of that, we have suffered over a century of communist revolution because Marx took it to what he felt was his logical conclusion.
So by the enslavement of the will, I assume you're meaning Luther's work, Bondage of the Will and Everything.
De Sacro Arbitrio.
So when you say that, though, by enslavement of the will, is it meant in the hyper-Calvinistic meaning that people don't make any choices whatsoever?
Yes.
The Lutheran Church, if you read the Formula of Concord, the epitome of it, it's a quick read. There's a solid declaration for more detail. We don't actually teach that humans don't make any choices whatsoever.
Okay.
We like to compare it. Like, again, I don't want to start a fight or anything. I'm wondering if maybe Hegel, however I say it, maybe he was going through a church at the time or professors that were teaching something that isn't taught in the confessions. We have a limited will, not a free will, not a completely bonded will.
Hegel was, I think that the accommodation had already been made. You can't have, that's an irrational claim to say that there is no free will. It's irrational. And in a sense, it did reach a culmination in America with Calvinism. And the whole American Renaissance, I studied literature, was basically a reaction against Calvin's notion of the enslaved will, okay, or predestination. The fundamental problem here, and to give Hegel credit, he is onto something when he talks about divine providence. There is an understanding of divine providence as the word that I'm talking about, that God is in control of every single facet of human history. Okay, now the Muslim, when he hears that, says, well, we don't have free will. Well, yeah. No, you what the paradox here is that you do have free will, and yet God is still in control of your life, of the outcome of your life. That's the paradox that is, again, at the heart of the Trinity, at the heart of what we're talking about. And so the orthodox interpretation of that would be the story of Joseph in Genesis, where the brothers basically commit evil. They're going to kill him. Instead of killing him, they sell him into slavery. He ends up in Egypt. There's a famine in Israel. They have to come to Egypt to beg for food, and they have to come to beg from the brother they almost killed. And what does he say to them? He says, Joseph says to his brothers, the evil that you intended to do to me has been turned by God's power into good. All of those words are important. Because what you're saying here is that there's no abstract mechanism of history. There's no necessity in history, which is where Hegel ended up with his dialectic, because he thought the dialectic was knowing the mind of God, which you cannot know. Okay? And so we've had all of these people with mechanistic understandings of history, including Adam Smith and his notion of capitalism, the invisible hand, which is basically a truncated version of divine providence cut off from the body. Okay, what am I saying here? That the only way this works is if there is an active, all-powerful subject called God who actively intervenes in human history, allowing free will and yet correcting it at the same time. So you have the two poles that are actually do work together. Absolute sovereignty on the part of God and absolute freedom on the part of man. Not absolute freedom. That's a wrong word. That's not theologically correct. But freedom of the will on the part of man and absolute sovereignty on the part of God, and both of them working together. And that's the agency of human history. And Hegel came close when he talked about the cunning of reason, die List der Vernunft. He came close to describing it, and then he almost got it, and then he collapsed once again back into Spinozan pantheism, which is compatible with the enslaved will.
So, all right, we have about 10 minutes left. One quick question from Miles Poland, our good friend and leader of the Godcast. He'd be so mad if I ignored the question. He said that in a podcast or a YouTube stream, you mentioned a connection between the Indian caste system and usury.
Yeah.
And he was hoping for a few more details on that, or else his hair was going to go gray.
Yeah, okay. This came, actually, part of the dialogue I've been talking about was with an Indian. He contacted me over the internet, and he talked to me about, what do you mean there's no logos in India? And I was parroting Hegel at that point, who said there was no history in India. And I said, well, obviously there is logos because we're talking to each other, and that's basic logos. But the development of logos stopped in India. And you have basically an irrational view of the universe. I said, it's, you know, the universe is a semicircle. It's the globe. And then it's on the back of four elephants, and the four elephants are standing on a turtle. And then I said to my friend, what's the turtle standing on? And he didn't know. He couldn't answer that question. The answer is on the internet. It's turtles all the way down, which means that's not an answer. But because he couldn't come up with the answer, he converted to Catholicism. Because Catholicism was logos. That was a logos. There was an explanation in Catholicism, and that is basically, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That's the real beginning. Anyway, he's pondering Indian history now from the point of view of logos, and you're confronted with the fact that logos started there. They have this Vedic term called irta, which is a kind of word for logos, and then it stopped. And he's saying, well, why did development of logos stop in India when it had a higher culture than, let's say, Europe 10,000 years ago? And his answer is usury. Basically, the moral fabric collapsed. They condoned usury. And then on top of that, they made a religion out of usury. And the religion of usury is known as the caste system. This is his understanding. And basically, you are eternally part of a group that is either on top or on the bottom. And this corresponds exactly to compound interest. There are two kinds of people in the world, the people who understand compound interest and the people who pay compound interest. And they correspond to the Brahmin class and the untouchable class in India.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah,
our friend John Franco here.
Yeah, sorry about that. I had some technical difficulties on my end. I'm sorry. Dr. Jones, big fan of your work here. I'm a Catholic, and coming out of the white guy circles, as you often refer to them, I find that one of the biggest stumbling blocks that I get when I'm trying to evangelize to other guys from the alt-right, trying to get them to see the light of the word, is the situation with the Pope we have right now. It seems like guys want somebody more orthodox, and it's hard for me to often get across the authority of the church when the person at the head of it often says things that a lot of us just don't agree with.
Yes.
How do we overcome that?
Well, tell them, mention St. Peter. Mm-hmm. St. Peter was the first pope, and Jesus Christ chose the man who denied him three times. So if you're going to, Jesus Christ never promised that every pope would be a saint. He never promised that every homily you attend in every Catholic church will be the greatest piece of oratory since Demosthenes. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. He never promised any of these things. What you have to give people a realistic understanding of what the church is. And Jesus Christ did talk about this when he talked about the parable of the boat in the storm. That's a realistic understanding of the church. That boat is the church. And the church is being tossed about in a storm because the powers of this world hate the church. And you're there and you think, I'm going to die. We're all going to die here. And it turns out Jesus is in the boat, but he's asleep. So the people go to Jesus and they say, don't wake up. don't you, aren't you upset that we're all going to die? And Jesus just gets up and he walks over and he calms the storm. And then he says, what is needed is faith. Well, that's true. That's exactly what's needed is faith, because the church is always going to be tossed about by storms. And it always seems as if Jesus Christ is asleep when you're in the storm. It's always going to be that way. But the what's the option? Well, you can jump out of the boat, and you know what happens then? You drown immediately. And the church fathers were unanimous in saying that this parable is about the church. The boat is the church. If you jump out of the boat during a storm, you will drown. It's that simple.
Excellent answer. Thank you so much. That's wonderful. I'm definitely going to be using that going forward.
So, that being said, we understand you're a busy man with a family and much work to do. Again, we thank you very much for coming on to the Godcast, and we wondered if you had any parting words before we close everything out.
Yes, thank you for having me on. It was a kind of high-level discussion, but you guys asked for it, okay? So don't ask if you don't want to know. And that's a preview of the Logos book. I'm working on it right now. I'm hoping to get it done by the end of the year. And you're right. It's part of basically a worldwide movement right now. There are people all over the world who are starting to understand the implications of the term Logos. Logos is rising, has now become a slogan. And you can contact us at culturewars.com. And if you connect with us there, you will know when the book comes out and you can rush out and buy a copy.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. For everybody listening, again, I believe there's only a few conclusions here that you could take is, you know, go get baptized. We have some reading for you. If you want to read Brother Lawrence's Practicing the Presence of God, we'll include a link for it for free if you would like. And again, we thank you very much, Dr. E. Michael Jones, for everything you've done here. God bless everybody, and pugnus pastorum.
Pugnus pastorum.
But with this acknowledgement that God fought for us.